Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Craig L. Simons, author of World War II at Sea, A Global History. We'll also hear from Megan Holt about One Book, One New Orleans. Craig L. Simons is Ernest J. King Distinguished Professor of Maritime History at the U.S. Naval War College and Professor Emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy, where he taught for 30 years. He's the author of many books, but today we're talking about his most recent, a massive volume titled World War II at Sea, A Global History. Craig Simons, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Now, this is a very fascinating and exhaustive book. So talk about the challenges of writing about the war from a global perspective.
Well, it is exhaustive and was a challenge to undertake. I remember when my editor at Oxford University Press first suggested it to me, I envisioned a multi-volume project. But I really wanted to tell the story as a single event. More than 100 years ago, Alfred Thayer Mahan talked about the oceans of the world being a great common. And in a way, if you think of it that way, they are all interconnected. So the war at sea, the war in the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Mediterranean, the North Sea, the Caribbean, were really all part of a single story. And I wanted to tell it that way. And it was challenging to do, but also a lot of fun.
I have this vision of you at a huge desk with a map and little boats all over the place, marking spaces like this fleet was here, this fleet was here. I mean, it's a lot to keep track of.
Well, it is. And it's important to remember, too, that a lot of the things that we think of as independent events were actually simultaneous events. For example, particularly of D-Day, which virtually everyone has heard of. But it took place at the same time. And in the same month that the Allies also mounted a major operation against Saipan in the Marianas, literally half a planet away. So the simultaneity of those operations reminds us that this is a single simultaneous event.
For lack of a better term, I'd call myself a lay reader. You know, I'm not an historian with a special expertise in this. But these are some of the things that I learned from this book. I mean, I think every now and then when we read a book about wartime, we get a fresh take on how the technology of war has evolved. And one of the things you bring home in this book is the importance of radar, for example.
Technology plays a big role throughout the war. And what's interesting is that war compels a society to rethink, readjust, and move more swiftly than it often does in peacetime. But war is an accelerator of technological change. And among the most important of all the changes in technology is radar. In 1938, 1939, it was very much experimental. A few sets existed, but only on shore bases or the very largest of combatants. By 1944, radar is not only on virtually all ships, it's in most airplanes. Mm-hmm. But the Allies had a better grasp on this than particularly the Japanese. The Germans were pretty good at it, but the Japanese, who early in the war dominated night fighting because of their better optics and practice, quite frankly, by 1944, the Allies could see in the dark, quite literally, with their radar systems. And that changed the nature of warfare.
And so did the use of the U-boat.
It did. Of course, the U-boat was not new in World War II. The Germans had used a war against the convoys off Britain in World War I as well, attempting to starve it into surrender, and had come quite close. A reprieve of that strategy in World War II could have come even closer if the head of the German U-boat arm, Carl Dönitz, had had the number of U-boats that he wanted when the war began, but he did not, in part because the Germans were dispersing their assets among the Luftwaffe, the surface navy, and the U-boats. And not really until late 1940-41 did they make a commitment to U-boat warfare, and by which time the Allies had developed not only countermeasures, but also had begun to build ships so fast that it was difficult for the U-boats to get ahead of that.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that came home to me over and over again were the weapon failures, like the torpedo technology. I mean, torpedoes caused an awful lot of casualties.
They did. The torpedo is the single most effective anti-ship weapon of World War II, but early on in the war, many of them did not work. Now, it's a scandal and a relatively well-known one that American torpedoes did not work early in 1942 and really throughout most of 1942, and that the Bureau of Ordnance, who was responsible for those torpedoes, was reluctant to admit that. They attributed the failure, the torpedo failures, to bad shooting by the submarine skippers, which was entirely unfair to the skippers. But it's less well known that the Germans had a very similar problem in 1940 and 41. Their torpedoes also did not work effectively. So even though the torpedoes were the most effective anti-ship weapon for the Americans in particular and the Germans as well, getting those torpedoes to work was quite a problem. Now, contrasted to that, the Japanese torpedoes were horribly effective. They had a torpedo called the Long Lance, a Type 93 torpedo that was longer and faster and employed new technology, compressed oxygen instead of compressed air, so that they were faster and packed a heavier payload than American torpedoes. And the Japanese made those torpedoes work very effectively early in the war.
Mm-hmm. You also touch on how naval warfare was intertwined with business interests of the war at large. I mean, for example, there's this problem with securing adequate iron for the construction of ships.
Well, both sides had to make choices in prioritizing what they could do. I mentioned earlier how Carl Dönitz, the head of the German U-boat arm, wanted all of the steel committed to building submarines, but Ernst Röder wanted all the steel committed to the building of surface ships, and Goering, who was the head of the Luftwaffe, wanted it for airplanes. And the same was true in the United States in that there were competitors for these raw materials. Now, the advantage that the United States had is that its industrial capacity was vastly superior, not only to the Germans, but to all three of the Axis powers combined. But even in the United States, decisions had to be made about what to prioritize. Do we build ships to carry goods over to Britain for the invasion? Or do we build escorts to protect those ships carrying the goods to Britain? Or do we build aircraft carriers or battleships or submarines, airplanes, tanks? There were competition for all these raw materials, and there were specific bottlenecks, steel plate being one of them. Steel plate was needed by everybody, and there was a finite amount of it. So the problem of deciding how to distribute your assets was one that the United States and really all of the combatants dealt with throughout the war.
Now, one of the things you brought home to me in this book, I mean, we often think of great battles like D-Day or the Battle of Midway, but you bring home over and over again how important the war on shipping really was.
That's true. I do talk about battles, and I think battles are exciting, and I like to talk about them, to write about them. But it is true that operations writ large, that is the great movement across the Pacific from Guadalcanal to Okinawa, or for that matter, the invasion of Europe at D-Day, or even the Mediterranean campaigns to North Africa, Sicily, and Italy, all of that requires shipping, not just the battleships, the carriers, the cruisers, and the couriers, but the good old Liberty ships, and particularly the landing ship tank, the LST. These were the workaday ships of the navies that made those operations possible. And it was a critical bottleneck for not only the Allies, but I think all the combatants, that everybody was always short of shipping. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why the U-boat peril was so dangerous, because if the Germans could destroy shipping faster than the Allies could replace it, they could win the war.
And you have such a great cast of historical characters to work with. Talk about some of the more interesting ones to you.
Oh, my gosh, that's a long list.
I know.
I mean, if you start at the top, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt are really key figures throughout the war. They are partners, but they are also rivals in a way. Churchill desperately needs the United States at a time when Britain was hanging on by its fingernails, holding the line alone against the Wehrmacht and the Axis powers in Europe. And then finally, when the United States becomes a belligerent, Churchill is still dependent on the United States for its vast industrial capabilities. So Churchill is reluctant to confront Roosevelt on strategic questions. On the other hand, he doesn't necessarily want to agree to American enthusiasm, some of which he considers naive and ill-considered, such as the instinct on the part of the Americans to go as quickly as possible into occupied Europe. You know, the United States, as a rule, we're not a patient people. When we decide something needs to be done, we want to do it immediately. And the British kind of quietly shook their heads to themselves and thought, oh, those Americans. But they didn't want to say that out loud for fear of disrupting the Anglo-American partnership. So there's a push and take back and forth between Roosevelt and Churchill throughout the war. And then, of course, there's Joseph Stalin, whose concern is that he feels correctly that the Red Army is carrying the brunt of the war against German land forces and wants a Western Front immediately, even if it means disastrous losses to the Western Allies. So there's that tripartite working out of strategy at the grand strategic level. And then on the next level down, you've got these dominant personalities, of course. On the American side, George Marshall, the calm, careful, thoughtful, strategic thinker who is at Roosevelt's elbow. And out in the Pacific, you've got Douglas MacArthur, who's Douglas MacArthur, dealing with his counterpart in the American Navy, and that is Chester Nimitz. And those two personalities clash on not only issues of policy, but on demeanor and temperament as well. And in Europe, you've got Eisenhower and Montgomery, and you've got Rommel, and you've just got all these personalities that flavor the story quite dramatically.
As do the Japanese commanders as well.
Yes. One of the most enigmatic individuals in this war is Yamamoto Isoroku, who is the combined fleet commander of the Japanese Navy. And he, aware of America's great industrial resilience, is a reluctant warrior in terms of having war with the United States at all. He's dragging his feet and is kind of compelled into accepting the idea that war with the United States is necessary because the Philippines sit in the pathway of Japanese resources in the Dutch East Indies. If the Japanese take the Dutch East Indies to get the oil they need, the Americans will still have their hand on the spigot by controlling the Philippines, so that obviously has to go away. And Yamamoto digs his heels in against this, but when it becomes clear that it's going to be war and he can't stop it, he says, all right, if you mad people are insistent on doing this, there's only one way we can survive this, and that is to take out the American fleet on the first day. If we do that, that will at least buy us time to create a defensive barrier in the southern Pacific so that we can protect these assets that we conquered, and maybe the Americans will eventually tire of the war. So, curiously, it's Yamamoto, the reluctant warrior, who insists upon the attack on Pearl Harbor that proves to be, of course, Japan's undoing in the long run.
Right. Now, it's to your great credit that so much of this is known, but you tell these stories with such drama and suspense, and it's, you know, the build-up to Pearl Harbor is a great thrill to read, actually. We've been talking with Craig L. Simons, whose new book is World War II at Sea, A Global History. You can meet him at the National World War II Museum. He'll be speaking Thursday, May 31st. There'll be a reception at 5 o'clock and a presentation on the book at 6. And then again, Friday, June 1st at noon, discussing Churchill's role on D-Day. Thank you so much, Craig.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
You're my baby and I love you so. I love you forever. And I swore by stars above, I'll never leave you ever. Well, Uncle Sam, he's taking me from my baby. Says he'll use me maybe. He wants to see me serve in the Air Force. Navy. Well, the dealio and dealie, I see my baby later, for I must go to Berlin in the Air Force U.S. Navy.
Megan Holt is one busy woman. She teaches in the English department at Tulane University, is the CEO of Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, and is the executive director of One Book, One New Orleans, the citywide reading initiative which is underway right now. Today, we're talking about One Book and how you could take part. Megan, welcome. I love our annual get-togethers to talk about one book.
I look forward to it every year. Thank you for having me back.
So the book this year is New Orleans, A Food Biography by Elizabeth Williams. So talk a bit about why this particular book.
Well, as one of my board members so eloquently put it, food brings everyone to the table. New Orleans, A Food Biography really chronicles that 300-year history of eating in New Orleans and how our city developed not just a food culture, but a real cuisine that distinguishes itself from the rest of America, and talked about how as different groups of people moved in, the cuisine adapted and became creolized, if you will, into this amalgam of cultural influences that we see today. It's a fascinating read. It really debunks a lot of myths we think we know about New Orleans food. And it's also something that everyone can relate to, whether you're born and raised here, whether you just moved here and came from a rich cultural tradition of food and now see that food being influenced by New Orleans and the other way around. You have a seat at the table when you read this book.
And there's so many programming possibilities. I mean, this isn't the first time you've done a food book. You did that wonderful book, Gumbo Tales by Sarah Rowan, as well as a one book selection. So what are some of the programming opportunities with Elizabeth's book?
One of the things that we really love is her section on cooking at home and cookbooks.
Yes, I love that one too.
I do. So one of the things we can do with that is have a community recipe swap, where everyone gets together, we bring recipes, we trade them with one another. Although if it's anything like my mother, people will bring a recipe that says, oh, you know, cook it till it looks right.
Or a dab of this.
Right, exactly. But it should be really fun to see that event come together. We have tons of food educators in the city, including Zella Palmer, who's going to do something with us in September. And the one that I am very excited about, because at its heart, One Book, One New Orleans is a literacy initiative, is our event with the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans in early November. What we're going to do is have different adult education programs from around the city teach this book. And the students there are going to write their own food memories, their own recipes, and we're going to compile it. And we're going to have New Orleans, the Untold Food Biography, and have that reading, have that exhibit, and that book will then be put on display in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
Yay!
So someone who is reading at a second grade level can bring their kids and grandkids to SOFAB and say, look, I have a piece here that I wrote. Mm-hmm. And I think that'll be incredibly empowering for a lot of us to see.
Because everybody has a food memory. Everybody has a food story.
Absolutely.
For one book, there is this core of volunteers that makes it happen.
Yes.
And it's hardworking,
yes,
smart people. But you have a lot of community partners that you're plugged into as well.
Absolutely. So I just mentioned one, the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans. We also work with WRBH Reading Radio. Right now, Elizabeth M. Williams is recording this book cover to cover with WRBH, and she'll be broadcasting that for the blind and print handicapped members of our community. So if they can't read it.
And it's so wonderful to hear it in her voice.
I know.
You know,
I'm so excited.
Really fun.
Last year was the first time I think an author had done that for us, and it was so amazing. We also work with the Pirate's Alley Faulkner Society. They've been a really invaluable programming partner. We work with Louisiana Books to Prisoners to make sure that those who are far from home can have access to this book, because we are the most incarcerated city in the most incarcerated state in the world.
And that's been a long-standing partnership, right?
Yes, yes. I believe it's over 10 years old now. And we just recently in April had our book drive for them and collected 174 composition notebooks, 33 how-to manuals, and 34 dictionaries that will be sent to prisoners across the Southeast.
And who are some of the other partners?
The NOPL. So when we distribute free community copies of the book, we make sure that every branch has a community copy or two or three. And that way, if you can't afford the book, we know that you can go to your local library and you can access it for free, because that's what we do. We choose our book, we encourage everyone to read it, and then we work our hardest to ensure that people have access when normally they would not. And then our last partner is brand new this year, CEEAS. The Center for Educational Excellence in Alternative Settings. They do educational programming for people housed in juvenile detention centers. And they're also going to be teaching our book in the juvenile detention facility. And their work will be part of the compilation that we do with the LAGNO.
Ah, that's great. So how many people do you think you'll reach overall with this book this time around?
I would probably say between all of our programming and our community copies, about 1,000.
That's a lot. That's a lot of folks.
Yeah, we're shooting for the moon this year. It's our first year as an independent organization, as you know. And so we're really trying to ramp up that outreach to a level that we've never seen it before.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about some of the things that have shown you that one book really has made a difference in people's lives.
Last year, we also did a compilation with the LAGNO. And last year, it was Clint Smith's book of poetry, Counting Descent.
Ah, that was inspired. That was an inspired choice.
It was amazing. We'd never done poetry before, but talk about the ability to bring a community together when you think about having poetry and having that sort of shared reading experience and how poetry is meant to be read aloud to people. So with the LAGNO last year, a group of students who were in a class where they read at a sixth grade level below got up and read their poetry that they had written, inspired by Clint's book. And one woman said, "I wrote about my daughter because everything that I did and couldn't do, she accomplished." So she read her poem about her daughter who's at LSU getting her master's degree, and her daughter was there.
Oh,
yeah.
Gives me goosebumps.
I know. I just had to stop talking because I got the chills. It's not cold in here. I just got the chills. So that was amazing to see. And the idea that it gave that family a chance to experience something. It gave that woman a chance to harness her newfound literacy skills to really pay tribute to what her daughter did and to what she herself did. It was amazing.
And how does one book plug into Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans?
Well, for 20 years, that was a project, a celebration, if you will, hosted by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, who is one of our community partners. Through that partnership, I became more involved in Words and Music because they would generously invite our author every year to do a presentation. And when Rosemary James, the founder of the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, decided it was time for 20 years of her directorship to end, she offered it to One Book, One New Orleans. And it's going to be an undertaking like I've never undertook before, but I'm so excited. I'm both overwhelmed and excited and nervous and thrilled at the same time. And the reason that we chose to do it, my board and I had a conversation about this when it all started unfolding, is we're looking at a way that Words and Music could become more integrated into the local New Orleans community. So our goal is we have a festival where people know the value of the written word. They spend their lives with it. And we use the proceeds from that festival to then invest back into the community, to buy more community books, to sponsor more outreach to underserved populations. Maybe we can have a scholarship. Maybe we can one day sponsor the GED graduation that the LAGNO does. The sky's the limit when you think about the possibilities of that. So we're hoping that Words and Music becomes something that is so cherished and beloved by New Orleans because they know that every cent goes back into our community. And we're also looking this year to play with Words and Music and the tricentennial.
Such a year.
Right? Yeah. And the food biography plays really well into that because it's 300 years of food. And so really showcasing our local talent in New Orleans at Words and Music and how our local talent has influenced the world. It'll be great.
It'll be super. What better than food?
What
right? to talk about.
Right.
So first up, you have a fundraiser, Juleps in June, coming up June 1st.
Yes, June 1st, right around the corner. And once again, our book is the hallmark. It's the highlight. It's what we're featuring. So we're looking at our rich culinary history and how we can highlight that at Juleps in June. Chef Susan Spicer is going to be there as well as Elizabeth M. Williams, and they'll both be signing their books. We also have some of the restaurants featured in Elizabeth's book generously helping out with the food. So Two Jags is going to donate some chicken bomb femme, and if you've ever had it. And then Second Line Brewing is going to generously donate some of the bar. So once again, local businesses stepping up for a local organization.
And for ticket information, you can go to onebookonenola.org.
Correct.
And tickets are at Eventbrite, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Super. We've been talking with Megan Holt, who's the executive director of One Book, One New Orleans. Pick up a copy of New Orleans, a food biography, and start reading today. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Mary DeMocker discusses in Science the Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. Tuesday, May 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tamalyn Dalal, author of the book 40 Days and 1001 Nights, discusses her book as well as the basics of Middle Eastern dance, Thursday, May 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Craig L. Simons discusses and signs his book World War II at Sea, A Global History, at the National World War II Museum. Thursday, May 31st, there will be a reception at 5, then a presentation on the book at 6. Friday, June 1st, there will be a discussion at noon on Churchill's role in D-Day. Tom Fitzmaurice discusses and signs the revised and expanded edition of Tom Fitzmaurice's New Orleans Food, Saturday, June 2nd at 4 at Octavia Books. Susan Eady signs her baby book, Poppy's Best Babies, Sunday, June 3rd at 2 at Octavia Books. Summer reading programs are getting underway at area libraries, and they have something to offer everyone, children, teens, and adults. The East Baton Rouge Public Library Summer Reading Program starts Tuesday, May 29th. Visit ebrpl.com for complete information or to sign up. The Summer Fun and Reading Challenge gets underway at the New Orleans Public Library June 1st and 2nd. Check out what's happening at your local branches or visit nolalibrary.org to sign up. Library Palooza, the grand kickoff for the 2018 Summer Reading Program, happens from 10 to noon, Saturday, June 2nd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and from 10 to noon, Saturday, June 2nd at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library in Harvey. This year's theme for children, teens, and adults in all libraries is Libraries Rock. Events are free of charge and open to the public. If you're a Walker Percy fan, you want to see photographer Jared Ragland's exhibit called Everything is Going to Be All Right, inspired by the moviegoer. It's on view at the front, 4100 St. Claude Avenue, until early June. One Book, One New Orleans hosts its annual fundraiser, Juleps in June, June 1st at 6 at 1413 Phillips Street, to support One Book and Words in Music, a literary feast in New Orleans. For ticket info, go to onebookonenola.org. You can buy tickets at Eventbrite. June 1st through 3rd is the annual Walker Percy Weekend in West Feliciana Parish, with an additional emphasis this year on the work of Shelby Foote and his long friendship with Percy. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org to buy tickets. The event is headquartered at Conundrum Books in St. Francisville. The Symphony Book Fair is coming up June 1st through 3rd at the Lakefront Arena in New Orleans. Hours are 9 to 8 Friday through Saturday, June 1st and 2nd, and 9 to 4 Sunday, June 3rd. There's an admission fee for a first look Friday from 9 to 3. This is the largest book fair in the South and includes art and music as well. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating New Orleans' tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send your favorites to LABooks at WWNO.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org.